Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, capitalizing on faith. Not far from the power brokers on Capitol Hill, the U.S.'s oldest Catholic university has been forming the leaders of tomorrow. And not just old bones, how relics have been venerated throughout the centuries. It is impossible to rightly govern a nation without God and the Bible. Spoken by George Washington more than 200 years ago, those words take on new meaning today. In a world governed by secularism and relativism, not to mention the ever-present debate over the separation between church and state. Whether one wants to admit it or not, without the Christian Bible and without God's laws handed down to Moses in the Old Testament, it's likely that civil society would not be so civil today. For well over two centuries, a Jesuit institution based in the U.S. Capitol has been training some of the finest physicians, politicians, and business managers in the world. And based just a few miles from Capitol Hill, Georgetown University has in some way made its mark on U.S. domestic and foreign policy. The oldest Catholic university in the United States, Georgetown can trace its roots as far back as 1634. Its students went off to fight on different sides during the American Civil War, but returned to form a united student body. That same spirit of reconciliation has formed the backbone of the university's post-9/11 programs, aimed at increasing understanding and respect between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Well, I sat down with Georgetown University's president, Jack DeGioia, recently for a chat about the university and its activities and asked him how the institution has, if at all, influenced the Washington political scene.
We were founded as the first Catholic and Jesuit university in the United States in 1789, the same year as the founding of our republic. And Georgetown University and our nation have kind of grown up synergistically in the same city with our federal government over the course of now more than 200 years. I think we've always provided a context in which certain kinds of questions and certain kinds of issues could be raised in the context of an academic community formed by a set of values that have animated the place over the course of our more than two centuries. And so when you look at the kinds of issues that our government wrestles with, and the kinds of issues that dominate the interests of the American people, being in Washington, we have the ability to take a longer view and perhaps a more reasoned view and to reflect more deeply on some of the key issues that sometimes can get a little distorted, perhaps taken out of a context that would enable us to establish the deepest understanding that we might be capable of an issue. For example, recently, we've been deeply engaged in the work of providing opportunities for interreligious dialogue and to expand our capacity for interreligious understanding.
This particularly after the September 11th attacks in 2001.
Exactly. We had a history of this. In the early 1990s, we established the first center for Muslim-Christian understanding in our country. And this emerged as one of the leading centers for this kind of dialogue in the world. But after September 11th, we looked at the resources that we had built at the university over the course of our recent history, over the last 40 or 50 years, and we realized just how much of a core set of strengths that we had in this area. For example, we hired our first rabbi as a member of our faculty in 1967, and then a full-time rabbi as a member both of our faculty and of our team in campus ministry in 1968. But what's most important is that in the context of the oldest Catholic university in the United States, we've had this thriving framework for our Jewish students to be able to explore their own faith and their own religious yearnings. And in the 1990s, we began exploring what were the needs of our community And we recognized that we had a number of Muslim students who were seeking the same kind of engagement. So we brought aboard and recruited Imam Yahya Hendi, who I know you've had the opportunity to have on your program.
Yes, I certainly have. Mm-hmm.
And the combination of Rabbi White and Imam Hendi, as well as a number of Protestant ministers, Roman Catholic priests, and nuns, created this rich community for us to provide our students with the opportunity of pursuing their own questions and their own identities from a religious perspective. But then we began to complement that with more and more of a focus on the academic, the scholarly, the research interests of our faculty in these areas. And so the work that we began in the 1990s on Muslim-Christian understanding was supported by a very large endowment gift from Prince Awalid bin Talal to support us, to endow what we had been doing for more than almost 15 years now with a wonderful gift that has secured that program for us. At the same time, another generous benefactor, William R. Berkeley, a member of our board of directors, helped us create the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, which looks at the nexus of religion in the world today, particularly from a political and from the perspective of how it informs the relationships between nations, but also how it is informing the unfolding political reality in our world today.
Tell me a minute about your student body.
Yes.
How many are Muslims? How many are Catholics, Protestants, Jews, and so on? And what is the interest on the part of the student body in
sure.
these interreligious dialogue courses?
Sure. Our student body is more than half Roman Catholic, and that's been our case for more than, I'd say, 30 or 40 years.
Is that a question of chance? Or
We work hard at it. We've always had a group of high schools in America, roughly 40 of them, who are either Jesuit high schools or very renowned Catholic high schools that have always enjoyed a wonderful relationship with the university and have provided us with many, many applicants for Georgetown. And we hope that we can sustain that balance over the course of changing demographics, both in our country and in our world. But we have strong percentages of both Muslim and Jewish students, and the second largest number of students would be Protestant. But the combination creates a very rich and lively community, and there's a strong, strong interest to be engaged in this kind of dialogue. My office is on the second floor of Healy Hall, which is the iconic building that you would see from many different points in the city of Washington. On the first floor of Healy Hall, as you enter the building, you have a series of offices. One is held by the director of our campus ministry, a Roman Catholic priest, and the next is the office of our lead Protestant minister, and then it's the office of our rabbi, and then of our imam, and then some more priests. And whenever I hear a racket downstairs, I always like to joke that that's interreligious dialogue at its best. Our rabbi, our imam, and a member of our Roman Catholic community team teach a course together on interreligious dialogue. But we've also served as a convener of some very important interreligious discussions that have taken place on our campus. And let me just mention a few of them briefly. The first is we have worked with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who each year convenes a dialogue called Building Bridges, where he gathers approximately 30 scholars, Muslim and Christian, for a very rich dialogue that has brought together some very important thinkers to explore the range of issues of interest to our respective communities. Well, two of the last four of those dialogues, we've had the opportunity and the privilege to host for the Archbishop at Georgetown University. And three members of our faculty have been deeply engaged in the dialogue, and it's been a wonderful experience for Georgetown to be able to feature that dialogue at our university. Last April, we were able to host the first gathering ever in the United States of the community of San Egidio, based here in Rome.
Sure.
And their International Prayer for Peace Conference was hosted on our campus last April, and it was an unforgettable experience for all of the members of our community.
And of course, St. Egidio is a lay community based here in Rome that has an outreach which is incredible with their HIV and AIDS programs in Africa, all across Africa. And they've had such amazing success with these programs.
We've worked so closely with them over the last 5 years. We had the privilege to honor Andrea Riccardi with an honorary degree from Georgetown in 2004.
Who's one of the, obviously, one of the founders also of St. Egidio.
Truly the spiritual leader of the community and one of the great religious leaders in our world today. And for Georgetown to be able to celebrate everything that he has meant to the church and also to the engagement and dialogue across religious boundaries was just one of the great moments for our university community.
Now, I know that you've been trying to get more and more involved as well in these HIV and AIDS awareness programs, also bringing, for example, St. Egidio and other Catholic organizations to Georgetown to explain their activities.
As I know you are aware, the community of St. Egidio runs one of the model programs for HIV/AIDS intervention in Africa. It began in Mozambique and now has spread to a number of countries throughout the continent. It goes by the acronym DREAM. It's a program that was one of the cutting-edge programs that introduced antiretroviral drugs into the regimen for responding to the crisis and has significantly reduced the transmission from mother to newborn. And what we've tried to do is provide a venue for the community to come to Washington and to share their work with a greater community in the United States, including our departments of state, our departments of health and human services. But also, we've been inspired by their work to try to see how Georgetown might be able to use the resources of an American research university to the engagement of the challenge on the ground in Africa. More than 30% of healthcare in Africa is delivered by Catholic organizations. And what we're trying to do is see if there's a way in which we can leverage the resources that we have access to in the United States as an American research university and make them available to this incredible set of organizations that are doing heroic work on the ground throughout the continent.
Do you also send your students out to Africa to witness firsthand these kind of programs?
We have a number of immersion programs. Every summer, we send a group of faculty and administrators to visit with a number of organizations, primarily in Kenya. But we also have a program in South Africa that is coordinated with one of the Catholic hospitals in Durban, with our School of Nursing and Health Studies, where a number of our faculty in the School of Nursing and Health Studies have been deeply engaged in trying to determine how our talents and resources can be made available to support the development of the programs there.
We've been speaking about the HIV AIDS initiatives that you have, also the interreligious dialogue. How have you seen these programs impact on the Washington political sphere?
Sure. Well, again, part of what we try to do as a university is to be a witness to the values that have animated Georgetown as a Catholic and Jesuit university for now 218 years. And so when we bring the community of St. Egidio to Washington and present them to the leaders in our city, we are trying to show different ways of being engaged in the world, animated by the kind of moral commitments that would characterize a community like ours. And so I think through a number of different ways, through a series of lectures, which we called Pacem in Terris, in honor of the 40th anniversary of the encyclical of Pope John the 23rd, through a current series that we have called Nostra Aetate, in which we've brought a number of leaders from around the world to Georgetown to offer their witness to the 40th anniversary of the Vatican II document that really set the framework for our engagement in interreligious dialogue. We've tried to present a number of examples of people who embody these values. It's remarkable how enthusiastic both our student body, our faculty, and the greater Washington community has been. There's a real hunger. Once one's tasted what it's like to be engaged in these questions, the hunger to go deeper After 9/11, in the American context, every one of us began to recognize ourselves as being distinctive from a Muslim community. We hadn't really appreciated the presence of Islam in our midst in the United States, the very broad range of Muslim communities that exist in the United States context, nor did we understand just how significant Islam was in the world. You could say that we were very myopic or insulated in our own way. And after 9/11, all those walls came down. And the questions that were raised and the ignorance that was exposed in all of our lives has led us to truly broaden and deepen the kind of engagement that we have. And there's an unbelievable hunger for this in our context.
Jack DeGioia is Georgetown University's first lay president. When my dad died, it took my family more than a year to go through his closets and drawers, to sift through decades of life and love, for memories to cherish and clothes to give away to people less fortunate than we. It was the little things we each saved, the cufflinks, the books, a lock of hair, a silk tie that kept Dad close to us even after his passing. The little things that tie our frenetic lives to his, the best memories to savor and to pass on to our own children. Saving an object that belonged to someone close to us seems to come naturally to most of us. In fact, it is very likely that the first Christians kept the very first relics to, in some way, keep alive the memory of Christ and his saints. Since the very beginning, Christians have venerated relics of all shape and form, pieces of wood from the true cross, the body of a past pope, the finger of the doubting St. Thomas, the blood-stained bandage of Padre Pio, or the skull of St. Catherine, just to name a few. Relics obviously don't possess magic powers, but the Church does see them as a way the faithful can come closer to a person who was deemed holy, and they can help us form a closer bond with God. But why do relics fascinate Catholics and non-Catholics alike? Or is the veneration of relics simply a macabre superstition? Well, my colleague Susie Hodges spoke to Elizabeth Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology, about what constitutes a relic and how the Church has viewed them over the centuries.
A relic is an object which can be a part of a body or clothing or something that belonged to a saint, which is someone that the Church recognizes as being in heaven. Therefore, while their souls are in heaven, this object remains on earth as something that we can remember our tie between the earthly matter and the saint's soul in heaven.
Do we have any idea when the practice of venerating relics first began?
Well, the practice of venerating relics is an extremely, extremely old practice. It goes all the way back. We have a very well-documented case of St. Polycarp, whose body ashes were gathered together, and they were, as the people of Smyrna said, they were treasured more than precious stones. So the idea of the body of a martyr being something to preserve, to venerate, to take care of, is a very old tradition indeed, 2nd century AD.
But it's not just bodies, is it? I mean, for instance, Christ's cross was very quickly became an object of veneration, and according to legend was broken up, wasn't it?
Yes, it doesn't have to merely be the body of a martyr. It is also, it can be an object that belonged to a martyr, but particularly the relics of Christ's passion have been extremely precious. The cross of Christ, of the crucifixion, was found by St. Helen in the early 4th century AD. By 354 AD, we know that the cross had already been broken up and sent across the empire because everybody wanted to have a piece, a part of this memory of Christ's salvific sacrifice.
Coming back, though, to the saints, it's true that at first the Christians, they venerated the saints, but they never actually dismembered the bodies. And yet afterwards they did start to do that. Why? Do we know?
Actually, it's a funny little break between the East and the West on this one. We have an understanding in the 6th century AD in the western part of the empire, in Rome, a request for part of the body of St. Peter, which Gregory the Great answers with by saying that we do not break up, we do not follow the custom of breaking up the bodies. In Rome, the custom was to lie a piece of cloth on the grave of a martyr, which would then be given or cut up or given to the faithful. Instead, in the East, the custom of breaking up the bodies, the custom of the body parts, is very, very old and very well rooted.
And at some point then they decided to follow the Eastern example.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the intermixing between the East and the West, particularly during the iconoclasm controversy, when the Eastern Church began to mix more with the Western Church. There was a series of Greek popes. I mean, there's a lot of intermixing which changed the custom. Also, similar to the fragment of the True Cross, it became also a question of ensuring that many different churches could have the relic of an apostle or someone extremely venerated throughout the universal church.
I know it must be difficult to pinpoint this, but can you think of some of the most famous or fascinating relics that we've had throughout history or even that survive to the present day?
Well, some of them, the interesting relics divide up into two categories. There is a category of relics that are very moving and still to this day very powerful. The thorn from the crown of thorns, the relic of the True Cross, as I want to say in the Church of the Holy Cross, it's the finger of St. Thomas that always catches my eye. The remains of certain saints, they're beautiful reliquaries with the heads of the four sainted Leos. So you have all four of the great Pope Leos in one reliquary. But then there's another class of relic, which are the completely specious, a little bit over the edge, crazy relics, which really come from an era of what could best be described as relic mongering, when everybody was so hungry for relics that they came up with all sorts of insane objects. Some of the darkness from the plague of Egypt apparently is bottled and kept in the Church of St. Mark here. Or you could have some of the breast milk of the Virgin. I mean, there were quite a few relics that
very inventive
are
people.
Very, very, very inventive. But that's when you know the relic situation has got out of hand.
But that was, as you say, back in the Middle Ages. Did it then afterwards sort of calm down a bit as perhaps people became a bit more better educated?
The Rome? Church has had to, if you will, crack down on several occasions, and going all the way back to St. Augustine. St. Augustine already warns about false relic mongers, people who dress up as monks and sell false relics. There are problems. There's another letter of a group of Easterners who came and dug up a bunch of bodies with the intention of bringing them back to the East, and here we're talking about the 6th century AD. So there's been a continuous ebb and flow of relic sales, relic fraud, and the church would crack down on them, particularly in the councils of Trent, when the situation really was brought under control in the reforming councils. The councils of Trent simply forbade any sale of relics, so there was no lucre attached to it.
But what's the church's official position on relics in the present day?
Well, the church's, it's the same position as it was at the time of the councils of Trent. The relics are there to be venerated. We are not to attach any kind of magical powers to them, because it's not the relic itself that contains some kind of magic. It is God's ability to do grace, to give grace through the object of someone who is very dear to him, a saint. And therefore, the church suggests or allows us to venerate relics, allows us to see relics as a kind of portal to God's grace, but to not ever attribute it to the matter, but to the supernatural, to the divine behind it.
Now, when it comes to Rome, of course, as the home of the Catholic Church, there must be a lot of famous relics scattered about the city. Can you tell us about some of them?
Rome has an astonishing quantity of relics, and the first collection of relics, the greatest collection of relics, was in the Palace of St. John Lateran. There was the Sancta Sanctorum, which is known at the top of the Holy Stairs today, and it was a private chapel where only the Pope went, which had the most most remarkable catalogue of the saints, relics of the saints, various objects. The catalogue was so precious, it was actually written in mosaic. It still exists, and the catalogue is written in mosaic form. At the same time, the relics that are most precious to Rome are the bodies of St. Peter and St. Paul, which for centuries, millennia now, people have come to venerate and remember St. Peter and St. Paul, who both died on the soil, and thanks to them, the Church of Rome was founded. There's another great collection of relics, which is in the Pantheon. One of those things that people don't know so much about, because the Pantheon is always, it's a pagan building. It was constructed as a pagan building. It was turned into a church in 609, but it became St. Mary of the Martyrs, because when the catacombs were emptied in the 7th and 8th century, the bodies were brought to the Pantheon. And on certain feast days, an incredible array of reliquaries can be brought out into the altar of the Pantheon. And so you see in this amazing building. Well, it's particularly Pentecost. The Pentecost is the greatest feast day for the Pantheon. It's the day that they drop the red rose petals in through the oculus. That's the greatest day of the year. But on other feast days, or even on a special mass, they'll bring out some of the reliquaries. But to see the altar arrayed at Pentecost is remarkable.
Now, many modern Christians, particularly from Western countries, you know, do tend now to consider them a rather macabre superstition relics. I mean, do you think the number of those who are rather skeptical about them is growing?
Well, I think in our day and age, we have become far more skeptical. Although I would like to say that plenty of people were skeptical in the Middle Ages, plenty of people were skeptical in the Renaissance. Skepticism is not something that the 21st century has a monopoly on. But we seem to have closed ourselves off to that particular form of supernatural. And it has a lot to do with ignorance, with not understanding exactly what the function of a relic is, and a lot to do with just not much information about them. Very few people really understand what a relic is, what it means to have the body of a pope under the altar at St. Peter's. And surprisingly enough, the catechism itself doesn't give a lot of orientation. It actually barely mentions relics at all. So it is a kind of, people have become distanced from what is an age-old custom in the church of venerating, remembering, wanting to be close to people who lived on this earth just like them, but have succeeded in making it to heaven.
Nonetheless, despite, as you say, there may be these growing skeptics, there are an awful lot of other people who are still fascinated by them. There was a recent exhibition, wasn't there, of a bloody segment of bandage belonging to Padre Pio. So how do you explain this continuing fascination, at least on the part of some of the faithful?
The remnant of the bandage of Padre Pio coming to Rome was a big wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people. They planned a little procession, maybe, you know, a few people from the parish would come. The place was packed. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people came to see the relic of Padre Pio. When the body of St. Augustine was brought from Pavia down to Rome to be near his mother, hundreds of people came. And so it tells us that, you know, that we are looking for that evidence of the supernatural. We're looking for, we still want it. It's that we're sort of shamed into having to take a more sophisticated, cosmopolitan, cynical, or skeptical approach, when indeed I think all of us in one way or another hunger to know that there's something greater out there, that there is some sort of contact, there's some recognition of the divine beyond our mundane daily lives.
Thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, a professor of Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus. She was speaking there to my colleague, Susie Hodges. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.